der Gefühl, die Lüge. Forestil dig, at du skal løse en vanskelig opgave. Nu siger jeg til dig, at højden på det rum, du vælger at løse opgaven i, får en betydning for, hvor godt du løser opgaven. Det lyder måske skørt, men de to amerikanske forskere, Joan Myers Levy og Julia Chu, har i en række forsøg vist, at menneskers tankekraft og problemløsningsfærdigheder afhænger af netop højden på rummet, de befinder sig i. Er den opgave, du skal løse, for eksempel en udviklingsopgave, hvor du har brug for din innovationskraft og fritflydende kreative tanker, så bør du vælge et rum med højt til loftet. Men hvis den opgave, du skal løse, er bogføring, regnskab i et stort Excel-ark, så bliver opgaven lettere, hvis du vælger et rum med lavt til loftet. De seneste år er der begyndt at komme mere og mere af den slags forskning. Forskning, som viser, at hvad vi som mennesker tænker, føler og oplever, afhænger af vores rumlige omgivelser. Og at bygningernes og byrummenes design i høj grad er medskabere, ikke bare den enkeltes livskvalitet og sundhed og adfærd, men af hele det sociale livs karakter. Bylyd skal dengang handle om det her forskningsfelt, som er i rivende udvikling. Jeg vil tage dig med til den anden side af Atlanterhavet for at møde to kanadiere, som er i fuld gang med at producere ny viden om, hvordan arkitekturen og byen påvirker mennesker. Du kommer på besøg i forskningslaboratoriet, hvor der både arbejdes med armbånd, som kan måle og teste kropslige reaktioner i byens rum, og hvor der bygges gunstige bymiljøer i computeren, som forsøgspersoner sendes ind i med virtual reality-briller på næsen. Mit navn er Niels Bjørn. Velkommen til. Jeg befinder mig i en tung betonbygning på et universitetscampus i den canadiske by Waterloo. Jeg er taget hertil for at møde psykologiprofessor Colin Ellert. Det er ham, som viser mig rundt.
Somebody told me once, and I don't know if this is true, but it looks to me like it might be, that the building was designed to be in the shape of a brain.
Professor Ellert fortæller, at bygningen, hvor han har sit kontor og sit laboratorium, er formet som en hjerne.
If we pass a map, I'll show you. Here's one.
You can see, you know, cortex, brainstem, even a pituitary. So if it's true, it's another demonstration that concept buildings usually fail.
Professor Ellert synes, det er en mislykket bygning, han arbejder i. Bortset fra, at den ligner en hjerne, som man altså synes er lidt pudsigt, så har han ikke meget godt at sige om den tunge, mørke betonbygning, opført i brutalistisk stil. Den er vanskelig at finde rundt i. Jeg mister hurtigt orienteringen. Men så når vi hans kontor på en af de øvre etager, og her skifter stemningen fra kold til varm. Jeg nævner for ham, at hans kontor virker som et personligt og rart rum at komme ind i. Det får ham til at grine og fortælle mig en historie.
Not so long ago, I lived for around a year in a little one-bedroom apartment that I was renting. And so suddenly I'd gone from a single-family home to this little box of space, and I wanted to personalize it. So I thought, I know what I'll do. I'll start sketching on the walls. So I did. I made it mine by sketching on the walls until a friend of mine said, you know, when you see movies with developing serial killers, you know how it always starts with them writing slogans on the walls? So I erased it all. I'll think of something else.
Professor Colin Ellert er nu så langt fra en seriemorder, som jeg kan forestille mig. Han er en utrolig venlig mand, og da jeg senere oplever ham sammen med sine juniorforskere i sit laboratorium, viser han sig også at være en generøs og varm rådgiver og forskningsleder. Colin Ellert er professor i neurovidenskab. Han er altså neuropsykolog af uddannelse og har forsket i hjernen i mange år. Først var det gnavere, siden blev det mennesker.
For omkring 10-15 år siden begyndte han at interessere sig for, hvordan de huse og byrum, vi befinder os i, påvirker os. Siden har han ikke kigget sig tilbage. Han er i dag en af verdens førende forskere inden for det, som kaldes psykogeografi, altså vidensfeltet om, hvordan mennesker oplever rumligt og interagerer med sine omgivelser. Colin Ellerts arbejde er at udvikle og afprøve nye metoder til, hvordan vi kan indhente viden om det fysiske miljøs påvirkninger af vores følelser, sanser og adfærd. Alt det skal vi høre ham fortælle om lige om lidt. Men først skal du også lige møde udsendelsens anden hovedperson, nemlig ham her.
I'm Charles Montgomery. I'm the author of the book Happy City and the founder of the consultancy of the same name.
Charles Montgomery er også kanadier. Han bor bare i den stik modsatte ende af det enorme land, end hvad Colin Ellert gør. Alligevel samarbejder de to og har gjort det i en årrække. Første gang jeg støttede på dem, var det netop et af deres samarbejder, jeg læste om. De to havde gennemført nogle eksperimenter med grupper af forsøgspersoner på byvandringer, som havde ført til nogle bemærkelsesværdige resultater. Det skal du høre mere om lige om lidt. Jeg spurgte Charles Montgomery, hvordan han havde mødt Colin Ellert og var begyndt et samarbejde med ham.
How did you and Colin meet up? Well, at a party. Isn't this where all great collaborations begin? I met Colin at a party in Vancouver. I think I was still researching the book, and I had read his book. And Colin is a person who brings not just the academic rigor, but an insatiable, playful curiosity. So he was willing to experiment. And then I was working with the Guggenheim Museum on the BMW Guggenheim Lab in New York City, and they gave us a bunch of money and said, you know, they kept calling it a laboratory. So I said, well, great, we get to conduct experiments. So I called Colin, and we put together our first collaboration, which was, we called it testing, essentially a way to test the arousal and well-being effects of different public spaces in New York City.
Det var netop de eksperimenter, Charles Montgomery begynder at fortælle om her, som var deres første samarbejde. Det begyndte som byvandringer i New York.
So we designed that first experiment in Lower Manhattan. That was the very first one. And the idea was to just begin to think about how to do a very basic study. We led people over the course of about an hour to 6 different locations in the city. And we set the experiment up in such a way that we could study contrasts that we expect that might make a difference. So during the walk, we take people from one location to another. We try to mix up the order a little bit because experimentally that's important.
Mix up the order of...
Mix up the order in which they visit the different sites.
Right.
As much as you can. I mean, there are constraints because we're dealing with real geographic space, so we can't just parachute people anywhere as you would in a laboratory setting. So in all of our walks, we always include a site that, as much as possible, takes people into a state of immersion and green space, because that's such a robust effect that we always think that if we're not seeing effects there, then there's something really wrong with our experiment. So we just took people to places. We asked them to indicate using a smartphone their emotional state, how pleasurable or otherwise they found their setting, how physiologically aroused they felt that they were. And then to back that up with some physiology, we had them wear bracelets that measured skin conductance. And then we administer all of the questions and the tests to them. We have them stand at each location for, depends how long it takes people, but typically a couple of minutes. We encourage them to just stand still and take in their surroundings for about 30 seconds. We point them in the direction that we want them to be paying attention to. And then we do our measures.
De første eksperimenter, som Colin Ellert og Charles Montgomery gennemførte sammen, var altså de her byvandringer i New York, hvor de tog grupper af forsøgspersoner rundt til forskellige typer af byrum. Undervejs opsamlede de to slags data. For det første bad de forsøgspersonerne om selv at vurdere deres tilstand i de byrum, hvor de gjorde ophold. For det andet havde forskerne påsat nogle armbånd på deltagerne, som målte deres svedproduktion, og dermed kunne afgøre, hvor aroused, altså hvor opstemte de var. Colin Ellert og Charles Montgomery kunne måle, at forsøgspersonerne havde ganske forskellige reaktioner, alt efter hvilke byrum de var i.
The blank, closed facade in front of a Whole Foods store on the Lower East Side. We compared that with another location that was just down the street that was filled with bodegas and bars and restaurants, and it was very permeable, lots of activity, lots of things to see from a vantage point on the street. And what we found in the that first New York experiment was that there was not only a difference between people's self-assessments of their states at the high and low permeability facades, but there was also a substantial difference in their levels of physiological arousal. In the permeable setting, that level of arousal was considerably higher than the baseline levels. In the low permeability setting, their levels of physiological arousal dropped to be lower than baseline levels. And
so what does that tell you?
Well, it doesn't, all by itself, it might be actually a good thing, you know, because you see the same kind of thing. If you take people into a nice lush park, you also see physiological arousal levels go low. But the difference is the valence of their experience, which so far we've only been able to get at by asking them questions about how they feel. In the low permeability facade setting, people have a nervous system that's to a great degree quiescent, but at the same time, they're not really feeling very good. They're not feeling pleasant. They're not attracted to the sight. And then the opposite is true in a green space. They're also physiologically calm, but they are feeling good. They're feeling happy.
De kanadiske forskere fandt altså frem til en vigtig forskel ved at have to datasæt af samme hold. Nemlig, at forsøgspersonernes kropslige reaktioner var små foran de lukkede facader, og de samtidig syntes, det var et kedeligt sted at være. Mens andre rum, hvor deres kropslige reaktioner var små, som i parken for eksempel, oplevede, at det var et dejligt sted at være. Den kropslige tilstand af manglende arousal betød altså to forskellige ting i de to forskellige rum. Og det var især sammensætningen af low arousal, altså lav kropslig opstemthed, med en oplevelse af ikke at være et rart sted, som Colin Ellert og Charles Montgomery blev særlig mærke i.
That combination in the low permeability site of low physiological arousal and a lower state of pleasantness and happiness, attraction to the site, that looks a lot like the signature that you see in laboratory studies of boredom.
How so?
I have a colleague just down the hall who does experiments. His area of expertise, in fact, is boredom. And he has done some experiments in lab settings where he has done his best to make participants feel really bored. And the way that he does it is to show the participants a movie of two men hanging laundry on a clothesline. It goes on, I think, for about 20 minutes. And there's not much to see, not much going on. And you see the same kind of thing. You see physiological activity go low. You see people's states of, their emotional states go low as well. They're not really very happy about the situation. And what's really interesting is that when you measure, we didn't do this, but he did. When you measure levels of cortisol, they increase in those kinds of understimulated settings. So that suggests that people are actually feeling stressed, even though physiological arousal is low, it's producing a level of stress.
Der er altså en kobling mellem kedsomhed i bymiljøet og stress. Kedelige bymiljøer kan udløse kortisol, som har kælenavn stresshormonet. Det er altså et hormon, som kroppen aktiverer, når der er noget galt, når den er stresset.
The immediate problem with boredom is the fact that it's not doing very nice things to your nervous system. If we suspect that states of chronic boredom are associated with things like increased secretion of cortisol, that boredom is producing stress, then it'll have all of the same kinds of long-term health effects that any kind of stress has on us. It'll leave us more prone to cardiac disorders, for example. I've looked at other places for answers to those kinds of questions. And so, for example, if you look at the literature on addiction in urban settings, and one of the most commonly reported things that people who suffer from substance abuse problems report when they relapse is that this is something they did because they were bored. And so it might be a little bit of a reach, maybe, to say that if you have very sterile, unstimulating settings in a city, that it might contribute to boredom that in turn might also contribute to relapse in the case of substance abuse. But maybe not. I mean, we don't know. We just don't have the numbers. The other kind of evidence that you can find that maybe connects with this, and again, it's an extreme case, but if you look at the literature on sensory deprivation, and this is, you know, everything from animal studies to studies of people who've been in solitary confinement, for example, there are really severe consequences to both one's psychology and the state of one's brain. In being in settings like that. And again, you know, you'd have to have a pretty dreadful city to even begin to make a serious comparison with a state of solitary confinement. But if you look at the animal research, the brains of animals that are raised in unstimulating settings are clearly impoverished compared to the brains of animals that are raised in more enriched settings. And there's every reason to think that those effects are universal, that they're just a consequence of how nervous systems grow and work. And we've known this. This is one of the most robust areas of behavioral neuroscience. You know, there are always these kinds of competing demands for how something gets built in a city. And I think it's often the easiest thing and cheapest thing to do is to build a long blank facade in an area. And I think that there's less sensitivity than I would like to see to the long-term effects of that on the people who live in the city. A less enlightened view might be that, oh, what does it matter? You know, it's just a wall, you know, to separate the inside from the outside. But it's much more than that if people are experiencing it or not experiencing it because they're repelled by it in a city space. So yeah, I think it's a big issue.
Efter de første eksperimenter i New York, blev Colin Ellert så optaget af de nye målemetoder, at han tog eksperimenterne videre, først til Berlin, siden til Mumbai. Projektet blev at finde ud af, om der var forskelle, som kunne spores i menneskenes reaktioner på de tre kontinenter.
When we did the experiment in Mumbai, it was my first time in the city. I was there for about a month, and I remember vividly my first day of arriving in Mumbai. I was staying at a nice hotel that was about 1 mile from the lab site where we were working, and so I thought, oh, I'll just walk. And that 1 mile walk took me about an hour, and part of it was because of the congestion on the street. Just the pedestrian congestion was unbelievable, but a big part of it also was the difficulty of crossing streets because the traffic congestion was also very high. It was kind of a dance to get across the street, an exercise in being able to process information about what you'd call time to collision. So, working out whether you could get across through several lanes of traffic without being hit by timing. And I found it incredibly stressful to do this. And so early on, I think even on that first day, I had local facilitators who'd grown up in Mumbai, and I said, what's it like for you to deal with this every day? And they said, oh, it's no big deal. You just get used to it. So what I did was when I designed the walk in Mumbai, I had one of the six stops in the middle of a traffic circle. And so the local cops thought we were a bit crazy, but we kept people sort of, you know, obviously we kept people out of the streams of traffic, but close. And we did the same kinds of things that I just described to you in New York. We asked people to indicate their levels of arousal, and we measured them physiologically. And we discovered that their self-reports in that location were, if anything, lower than they were anywhere else on our walk, but their levels of physiological arousal were at their highest in that location. And so,
what does that tell you?
What that suggests to me is that when people say that they are used to something, it doesn't mean that their bodies are no longer responding to the situation, in this case, I think, in a negative way. It means that they have become accustomed to undergoing periods of high physiological stress.
And as a psychologist, what does that?
Well,
what kind of piece of information is that for you?
Well, it's really valuable because I think it's got a couple of implications. I mean, one of them, again, has to do with this idea that we can't necessarily always trust self-assessment tools to get at what's happening to people's bodies and their minds, especially. But the other thing is that from the applied standpoint, what that suggests is that people are in situations where they're undergoing enough physiological stress that it's very likely to be having chronic health implications over the course of their lives, and they probably aren't inclined to do anything about it.
Does that actually mean that you kind of disconnect your own sense of your body?
Yeah, I think probably there is some of that going on. Disconnect might be a good word. Discount. Assume that because you've seen this before and you've experienced this physiological state, it's fine and it won't hurt you to experience it over and over again. And I think that's probably not true. I mean, one of the things that I'd like to do is to go beyond simply measuring people's levels of physiological arousal via skin conductance and look at something like cortisol secretion in that population to see how traffic is affecting them, and maybe in an experience similar to the one that we set up before. And I would predict that, you know, just as in other studies, cortisol is going to be high.
De to kanadiere Colin Ellert og Charles Montgomery laver stadig eksperimenter sammen af og til. Men udover hvad de gør sammen, har de også hver sin retning og er baseret i hver sin ende af Canada. Psykologiprofessor Colin Ellert arbejder i den østlige universitetsby Waterloo i den brutalistiske bygning, der er formet som en hjerne, som han fortalte i starten af programmet. I kælderen under sit kontor har han et virtual reality laboratorium, hvor han leder en række juniorforskere, som foretager forskellige eksperimenter ved at opbygge forskellige typer af bymiljøer i computeren, som de herefter afprøver forsøgspersoners reaktioner på. Jeg gik med ham ned i laboratoriet og mødte hans forskere, og det er spændende, hvad de har gang i. Det kommer vi tilbage til senere i udsendelsen. Charles Montgomery bor i Vancouver i den vestlige del af Canada, hvor han leder en virksomhed, der arbejder med at bruge forskningsresultater i praksis, altså bruge den viden, som han finder i forskningsmiljøer, og lægge til grund for rådgivning i, hvad der er gode og mindre gode måder at bygge bygninger og bymiljøer på.
Most often than not, we're learning from academics like Colin, rather than doing the original research ourselves. So, you know, anytime I hear Colin say something like this, I'm fascinated and I follow his lead. I think where we see ourselves with Happy City, we're a bridge often between the academics and the practitioners. And so tomorrow I'll be speaking at a Safe Streets Summit here. And, you know, Florida has some of the most dangerous streets in the world, right? More dangerous than the streets of Sierra Leone because of fast-moving traffic. So I'm getting to my segue here. This does relate to Colin's research, that notion of being fascinated with your environment. Because if we want people to move in more active ways, to walk or bike, they need more than just a bike lane and safe sidewalks. They need shade, and they need to be visually interested. Because we've found, and this relates to Colin's work, academics have found, and we've summarized, that people just don't walk as far in boring environments. We won't walk 200 meters between two big box stores in a parking lot because it's boring and unsafe, but people will walk up to 800 meters to shop along high streets where there's lots to see along the way and it's comfortable. So Colin's work is relevant in ways that he may not realize when he's first studying those things. And so that's why it's such a thrill to work with him, because we can compare practice to theory and then experiment and learn something new. So I think we are currently in a discussion. One of our team is meeting with I believe it's the Minister of Happiness from Dubai in a couple of weeks. Wow. And we're trying to convince them they need to be applying some of this research and conducting new experiments on the effects of the places that they're building. You know, they have a national goal now to be the happiest place in the world. Terrible mistakes have been made around planning and design in Dubai or in the Emirates generally. And those mistakes in many cases can be reversed.
Måske lader du mærke til, at Charles Montgomery for lidt siden snakkede om Floridas veje som farlige. Og måske kan du også høre det på lydrummet omkring hans stemme. Jeg møder ikke Charles Montgomery i Canada, men i Florida på en strandpromenade ved Hollywood Beach en solskinsdag i januar måned. Der er fyldt med mennesker. De fleste er over 60 år gamle. Folk er i shorts, hvide tennissko, flip-flops, bikinier. Det er sådan en lang stribe, fuldstændig lige af en boardwalk, hvor der på den ene side ligger den her strand, som måske er 10-12 meter bred. Fin hvid sandstrand med palmer på. Og det, der adskiller stranden fra boardwalken, det er sådan en lille mur, måske 40 cm høj, fin at sidde på. Og så løber der en cykelsti og et bredt gangfelt, som er altså her sådan en torsdag formiddag, slutningen af januar, er ganske fyldt med mennesker. Det er også høj sol, der er måske 24-25 grader. Og nu fik jeg lige lidt vanddrupper på mig, fordi der står en mand, som kommer ned fra stranden. Og har sikkert været ude at bade, og så skyller han sig lige under den bruser, der er mellem stranden og boardwalken, så man kan skylle saltvandet af. Og det viser altså, at der var en lille brise, som fik fat i det vand og kaster det hen på mig.
Look, the environment we're in here is an environment purpose-built to extract dollars from tourists. And it does that very effectively. Does it function really well as an urban system? Well, every tourist who's come here needed to get here in a car at significant expense from an airport nearby. The traffic is horrendous. The people who work here, the people who serve the tourists here, have to line up at the bridges over to these beach communities every morning. They have very long commutes, and so that's not easy for them. It's also very expensive for them. Along with the cost of housing, you're paying a huge amount just to get to work every day in an environment like this. Okay, so let's come back to the boardwalk. It's lovely. People are walking. They're enjoying themselves. It's sunny. This is a Canadian senior's idea of a place to be in winter.
Yes, and a Dane as well. I mean, if I come directly from Copenhagen this time of year, being very cold and dark, and I would come here, I would, for the first few hours, be ecstatic and happy just because of the sun and the beach. But then I think after a day or two, I might find that there's not a lot of excitement going on. You have bars and restaurants and hotels, and that's it. So what kind of an idea of an, you say it's created for a purpose, what kind of an idea of an urban setting is this?
It's funny, you've used the word urban several times. I don't feel I'm in an urban setting right here. I feel we could be on a cruise ship. We could be in a gated community. We could be in Disneyland. It doesn't function as an integrated part of an urban system. So we have an active pathway. We have a fairly beautiful natural environment with palm trees and sand. You can get in the water, which you can't do in West Palm Beach. But more, I think, to the point, and a point which is relevant for many urban places, we have small urban retail and services. That's what gives this place life. That's what slows people down. In our research, we found that not only are people happier when there are small shops and services, reasons to slow down, but they're kinder to each other.
So the scale of the businesses is important.
The scale of the business is crucial, and I think this is what so many growing cities get wrong. I think it's what's going wrong in Ørestad, is it? Outside of Copenhagen.
Yes.
You know, we love the word or the phrase mixed use, and we think if we can get mixed use, then we'll have succeeded. Well, we're learning that even when you mix your uses, say business or residential above and commercial activity or service on the street, you got it made. Well, not quite. If you don't get the grain fine enough, you still have a dead environment. You still have a place that's less friendly, less social, less healthy because there are fewer places to walk to, and less safe, and ultimately less happy.
Det er netop byen som et designsystem, Charles Montgomery er optaget af at beskrive. Han er ikke forsker, men oprindeligt uddannet journalist. Og det var som journalist, han først begyndte at interessere sig for sammenhængene mellem det fysiske miljø og mennesket. Hans nysgerrighed førte ham på en lang researchrejse hele jorden rundt. Han opsøgte forskere, byplanlæggere og arkitekter, og han indsamlede viden om gode og dårlige måder at designe og udvikle byer, kvarterer, gader og bygninger på. Hans research blev til bogen Happy City, som jeg varmt kan anbefale alle, der er interesseret i stoffet her. Som du kunne høre, da han nævnte Ørestad, har København også sin plads i bogen. Men Montgomery's rejse begyndte et helt andet sted.
So, I wanted to go back and ask you, what was the point of departure for you in creating this book?
Well, the official story is that I met Enrique Peñalosa, who had been the mayor of Bogota, and who had used, or claimed to have used, his three-year term, his first term at the end of the 90s, as a, well, specifically to redesign his city to boost happiness. And I was captivated by the idea, and I chased him around his city, and was so intrigued that I just couldn't let it go. And I wanted to, as a journalist, understand if that hypothesis was correct. So I pursued it for years. But the truth is, as you've sensed maybe in our talk this morning, I'm a very irritable person, and I get angry with cities, and I was angry with the cities I was inhabiting myself. I was angry with my urban experience, and I wanted it to be richer, easier, more fun.
So the anger, is that the unofficial story? You start by saying the official story was...
That's right. The anger is the unofficial story. But of course, a book called Angry City might not sell.
Et af de aspekter, som Charles Montgomery er optaget af, er, hvordan vi skaber bymiljøer, som er socialt rare steder at være. Det vil sige, at de skal være steder, hvor vi har tillid til andre mennesker, selvom vi ikke kender dem. Til at undersøge sammenhængene mellem tillid og det fysiske miljø, har han gennemført forskellige eksperimenter.
But we have another sideways question, and we call it the wallet question.
Yeah.
So I'd say to you, you know, if you dropped your wallet somewhere here today, and a stranger found it, what are the chances you get it back? Now, we find there's actually not a really strong correlation between people's trustworthiness and someone's answer to the wallet question. In other words, most of us think other people can't be trusted. But when you scatter wallets, dummy wallets, around a city, they end up being returned. I think the return rate is often around 80%. And we've done experiments where we just use that wallet question in various public spaces to see the effect it'll have. But rather than tell you what happens, because I think the effect is pretty obvious. When people slow down, when they're in lovely places, when they're in places that feel social, they're more trusting. But the flip side of that is, well, can those places actually influence how kind people are to other people? So not just how they rate the trustworthiness of others, but how they treat other people. So we did a little experiment in Seattle, where we used volunteers to pose as lost tourists. You know, we just got them to look like really stupid tourists holding up maps, standing there, looking completely helpless. And then we measured them in various environments. And then we watched to see how pedestrians treated them. And what did we find is that, you know, in a slow environment with small shops, small services, lovely street edge, people were 4 times as likely to stop without being asked and offer help to our lost tourists.
Om vi imødekommer et fremmed menneske med venlighed, åbenhed og tillid, har altså ganske meget at gøre med, hvor vi støder på det. Et bymiljø kan være designet på måder, som får os til at slappe af, samtidig med at de virker behageligt stimulerende. Den slags steder sker der flere og mere tillidsfulde interaktioner mellem mennesker. Hvis bymiljøet omvendt er designet på måder, som gør os utrygge, mistillidsfulde og stressede, vil vi helst undgå kontakt med andre mennesker. Så hvis vi altså vil have byer, som fremmer tillidsfulde møder mellem mennesker, skal vi være omhyggelige med, hvordan vi udformer og tilrettelægger de rum, vi har til fælles i byen. Med deres byvandringer i New York, Berlin og Mumbai viste Colin Ellert og Charles Montgomery, at der både kan være miljøer, som er for lidt, det vil sige så lukkede og æstetisk fattige, at det udløser kortisol i kroppen. Og at der kan være miljøer, som fører til kortisoludløsning, fordi der er for meget information til, at mennesker kan kapere det hele. Der er altså et vigtigt punkt for den positive menneskelige oplevelse, som handler om den rette mængde stimulans. Colin Ellert uddyber, hvordan det hænger sammen.
Daniel Bertelheim was an experimental psychologist, and as he saw it, all animals, including human beings, but not just human beings, were motivated by the desire for information. He did all kinds of experiments on everything from cockroaches through rats to people. It was an empirical finding, he argued, for this inverted U-shaped function between complexity and attraction, pleasure. So that there was this sweet spot where we had opportunities to learn enough that was new to satisfy this desire for information that he thought we shared with everything living, but not so much that we began to have difficulties processing it.
For Colin Ellert er det her sweet spot of complexity altså vigtigt. Men hvad kan være de menneskelige konsekvenser, udover stress, hvis ikke bymiljøet har det rette niveau af stimulans?
We have done experiments on wayfinding. For example, I'm thinking of a study that a student of mine named Kevin Barton did in virtual reality, where he presented people with quite large virtual environments, and their task was to find their way through them, basically to find a hidden target, and then to find their way back to their starting point. And we had different environments that were either pretty easy to find your way through, maintain orientation, or really Byzantine and difficult. And people showed lots of stress, lots of physiological arousal, and effortful cognitive processing in situations where they didn't really know where they were. So I think, you know, part of feeling disoriented is just frankly an unpleasant feeling. When people lose a sense of where they are, they experience a loss of control, which is not pleasant. But I think that sense of loss of control can change the way that we behave. People who've designed environments, special kinds of environments, for example, casinos, IKEA stores, shopping malls, there have sometimes been explicit design elements in those places that are there to disorient people. And the joy of, for a retailer, the joy of disorienting people and that relinquishing of a sense of control is that they're willing to give that control over to someone else. So there are studies, for example, showing that when people are in that state, they're more likely to make an impulse purchase. So that's a very specialized kind of setting and a very specialized kind of finding. But generally what it's suggesting is that when we're disoriented and we experience that feeling of loss of control, we're maybe more likely to do things that aren't good for us.
Colin Ellert nævner virtual reality som et redskab, han og hans hold bruger i deres forskning. Faktisk var Colin Ellert en af de første, som begyndte at bruge virtual reality inden for byforskningen.
You've been doing research with using VR for years.
Yeah,
how did you first get into that, and why did you find that field fascinating?
Well, we got our first helmets maybe about 10 years ago. And the very beginning for me was that I had a bit of grant money left over at the end of a cycle. I had just enough to buy one, at that time, pretty good helmet, but by today's standards, not very good. And so I thought, let's just get one and see what can be done with it. And we basically played with it. We got into things in a bigger way later on when we built our VR lab. And the big attraction for me, I was really naive at the time, but I thought, okay, we want to understand the relationship between behavior and spatial settings at every scale, from urban scale to room interiors. Why not use a system where we can basically simulate anything? You know, anything that we can model, we can put into people's heads with a VR helmet. And I had this naive expectation that it would be just the same as real life, which was pretty quickly beaten out of me by the results of experiments where you never get the same. You never get a perfect match between what people do in a simulated environment and what they do in real life. And I don't think we know all of the reasons for that. And you can actually do some nice experiments. We're actually working on experiments now. I have a student, Robin, you'll probably meet him if you come downstairs, who's looking at pedestrian dynamics on a sidewalk in VR. It's not quite running yet, but the idea is to look at situations in crowded sidewalks where there's you and there's a bunch of other people, in our case represented by avatars. And as everybody knows, on sidewalks there's a lot of, you know, dynamic interaction. You yield or you don't yield, you partially yield and so does the other person. Things don't always go very well. There's often an emotional state that accompanies all of this. So Robin's hoping to model a lot of that in VR and see how those kinds of dynamics are affected by our surroundings. You know, if you're negotiating a crowded sidewalk in a really dense, oppressive setting in a downtown core, is that different to if you're walking down a pleasant street full of low rises and nature?
So the reason to do it in VR is that it's easier to change the physical setting.
Yeah.
Rather than if you have to go out and find those settings in the real world.
Yeah, that's right. And so, you know, we were talking a while ago about complexity. And one of the problems with the New York experiment and every experiment that we've done since then is that if you want to compare people's behavior in settings of a number of different values of complexity, you have to find them and they have to be pretty close together. And that's often difficult. You know, that's not even mentioning all of the crazy noise variables that take place on the street. You know, everything from the weather to the drunk person who comes and starts heckling your experiment. In a VR experiment, you can just select whatever levels of the variable that you want, and you know that you're immune to all of those kinds of noise variables. But then, again, the question is, you have to be careful about whether what you're showing in VR is the same as what happens in real life.
Lige præcis den her snak om, hvad virtual reality kan bruges til og ikke bruges til, hvis de menneskelige reaktionsmønstre er forskellige. Fortsatte vi senere på dagen, hvor Colin Eller tog mig med ned i kælderen under den brutalistiske betonbygning. Her ligger hans virtual reality laboratorium. Og jeg fik lov at være med på det ugentlige møde, hvor forskerne og deres studerende mødtes og delte en update med hinanden.
Hey, here we are.
Hello.
Hello, hello.
How are you?
Good, how are you?
Good, good. Vidrant, nice to meet you. How are you doing?
Nice. Rob, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Hello.
Sure. I have to take off at 12:20 for a presentation I have to give.
Okay, yeah, you can go first then.
Sure.
Hi, I'm Hannah.
Hi, I'm Nils.
Nice to meet you.
Under mødet dukkede diskussionen igen op om, hvad forskellene er på reaktioner i virtual reality-universer og reaktioner i fysiske universer. Jeg havde selv kort før jeg tog til Canada haft en oplevelse med det, som jeg fortalte forskerne om.
So I was recently in a VR studio, and I had that same experience of suddenly, you know, the ground underneath me was not there, and I was in a tall skyscraper, and I just went through the wall and was outside, and the streetscape was so far below, and it was frightening. I did not like that at all. And that was immediate and visceral. So there was no translation in my mind that had to take place.
It's automatic, right? Like
it's automatic, yeah. As you said, there's different. You can detect different responses in these two different environments. Mm-hmm. So there are differences, but what are they?
Yeah. Well, that's a really important question for us, because we want to use this kind of technology to further our understanding of how people act in the real world. But we don't know what the, you know, you're right, there are some really obvious and visceral connections that people make in real environments. There's a classic demonstration virtual environments. There's this classic demonstration of the pit, so-called, where people have to walk a plank across a pit that's beneath their feet. And you can see, I mean, if you experience it yourself, you know the anxiety, like the anxiety that you felt. If you watch someone doing it, you can see in their posture and their movements that they're behaving as though they actually are suspended above this thing that they know is not there. At the same time, when you you look at the closest comparisons that we've been able to make between virtual environments and real environments, where one would expect to be able to predict behavior in a real environment based on VR, the predictions don't pan out all that well. And it's still a bit of a mystery as to why there is that mismatch. So we may be tricked to the extent that we may feel vertigo when we're hovering over something tall, or we may duck our head to avoid bumping into a cabinet. That's something that we've seen in some of our rendered houses. But nevertheless, it's not, we don't treat it in every way as if it's real. So we want to find out where the departures are between real and virtual.
Yeah, and there's an issue of it being visual, of course. So if you close your eyes, you're immediately out of it.
Yeah.
So the other stimuli you get through your skin and through your ears don't follow.
That's right.
And that's what tricks my mind sometimes, because I remember just from having that experience that I just mentioned to you, it felt like I had like a discussion in my brain about one part was having that experience of anxiety, and the other part was discussing, this is not real, you know, and going back and forth between those two. Yeah. So it was like they were both there at the same time, but but having conflict between them.
Yeah. I once said it felt a bit like, for me it does, like lucid dreaming. You know, if I'm in the helmet in some virtual room and somebody talks to me in the physical room, then it's as if I'm in a dream, and then that's, you know, I still know, like there's still a differentiation between the two realities, the physical one and the virtual one. But I don't, like I said, I don't know how to think about all of that in the context of using VR as a tool to predict people's responses in real settings. And I think you're right. I think other senses probably contribute. I think a sense of embodiment is important as well. We did some experiments, for example, with, believe it or not, with people with Parkinson's disease in virtual reality. And we found that they had a difficult time walking until we gave them a body. So they actually, we had sensors on their legs so they could look down and see not their legs, but they could see
legs,
renderings of legs that moved in accord with them, their own legs. And that made it easier for them to actually walk.
Forskerne fortalte mig om de forskningsprojekter, de aktuelt arbejder på. Der er Robin.
So I'm Robin. I started my PhD here in January.
Som undersøger, hvordan menneskers kroppe reagerer på at være omkring skyskrabere.
So I'm looking, right now, one of my studies is looking at the impact of, I guess, being in the presence of skyscrapers.
Det gør han ved at putte forsøgspersoner ind i virtual reality-universer, han har skabt i computeren. Så måler han deres puls og hjerterytme, og han måler på deres svedproduktion.
And we're also using an implicit affect measure to get a bit more of like a compelling story about it.
Der er Megan, som forsøger at finde ud af, hvor store mængder grønt, der skal være i bymiljøet, for at det opleves som et skønt og behageligt miljø at være i.
Especially trying to find some kind of dose response curve. So far, there hasn't been a whole lot in the research looking at what percentage of green space like trees can affect people.
Findes der sådan en grænseværdi for det, undersøger hun.
So maybe we could find an exact amount of green space to add to different areas.
Og der er Hannah,
I'm Hannah,
som undersøger, hvilke rum i byen folk oplever som private eller offentlige i forskellig grad, og hvorvidt deres følelse af ejerskab til stedet hænger sammen med det.
I'm also interested in spaces that sort of are ostensibly public but are actually private and highly controlled spaces.
Like commercial spaces?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Vi må desværre vente et par år, indtil vi får resultaterne af den forskning.
Bye guys, nice meeting you. Thanks for letting me sit in.
Jeg slutter min dag med psykogeograf Colin Ellert tilbage på hans kontor med at spørge ham, hvorfor han gør, hvad han gør.
Yeah, why do I do what I do? I suppose the first answer I would always give to that question is that I'm driven by curiosity. I mean, I always have been. It's always been driven just by an interest in how things work and how people work and how minds are put together. But what I'd like to think about the work that I do now is that there's prospect for it to actually contribute to sometimes more intelligent ways of thinking about how cities are built. I don't think that we're there yet by a long shot. I mean, the most commonly asked question for me is, how do you get your findings to actually make a difference to the people who have the wherewithal to build and plan in cities? So the answer that I always give is, our job is to collect the data and to show the findings, and when an informed policymaker looks at the data, of course they're going to say, well, we have to do this. But I know that the world is a lot more complicated than that, and that's outside of my area of expertise, which again, when I say that, I feel like it's a little bit of a cop-out.
So you're not going to change into a lobbyist?
No, I'm not going to change into a lobbyist. Maybe a better approach for me is to make friends with lobbyists.
Colin Ellert forsker altså for at bringe ny viden for dagen om, hvad det fysiske miljø kan gøre af godt og dårligt ved mennesker. Og han ønsker sig, at den viden, han og hans kolleger bringer for dagen, finder vej ind i konkrete projekter og beslutningsprocesser. Men han ser det ikke som sin opgave at sørge for, at det sker. Det gør til gengæld Charles Montgomery, journalisten bag bogen Happy City, som jeg møder i Florida en solskinsdag i januar måned. Han har gjort det til sin levevej at bringe viden om evidensbaseret design ind i konkrete projekter og på den måde bygge bro mellem den akademiske verden og praksis.
We help cities, developers and other entities build happier, healthier places. But the tools we use run a spectrum. On the one end of the spectrum, you know, sometimes we'll just talk about our work. But we like to draw people more deeply into this evidence-based understanding of well-being in place.
Men Charles Montgomery har ved flere lejligheder oplevet, at den afgørende faggruppe ikke altid ser så positivt på evidensbaseret design. Den faggruppe er arkitekterne.
You have this you have this architect, Bjarke Engels.
Yes.
Who's a total sweetheart, and yeah. I think a very thoughtful playful designer of places. And I once asked him, I think about the figure eight building, he had said, you know, this is a building that produces happiness. And I said, oh, great, I would like to see your post-occupancy surveys. And he said, oh, well, no, I mean, I have a friend who lives there and he's quite happy. And to me, not to single him out, but this seems quite fairly typical of the architect's response. So we found in our work that often architects are inspired by metaphor, and in metaphor they see evidence. Well, we know a metaphor is not evidence. We know they love it when the evidence supports plans they're already making, and we see very little investment in a study of what they're doing or post-occupancy survey.
Jeg spørger ind til, hvorfor Charles Montgomery har forladt journalistikken til fordel for arbejde med at bringe evidens ind i byplanlægning og ind i arkitekturen. Og så mærker jeg, at jeg rammer hans bløde punkt.
This points to a larger issue. Look, we here we are, a couple of middle-aged guys. We have money, we have freedom, we have power. And when you talk about a place like Dubai, or frankly, Florida, we need to talk about who's included and who's excluded. This has made the biggest impression of me, on me of all in Florida, is that the notion that so many are excluded from the richness of urban life here. In West Palm, well, Palm Beach, it's very hard on that coast to find a public beach, for example. And then when you do find a public beach, you might find a beautiful pier that you have to pay to go on. I mean, that's just one example. Looking at mobility here, it's people who are on welfare, who are on homeless, cannot enter the market economy here because they can't afford to move around and get to the jobs. So, you know, I know we're talking about the neuroscience of place, but there's a tremendous stress attached to just getting around in these cities.
So that's actually a point I wanted to talk to you about, because it seems that, you know, you make a very good story of how the goal is actually to make people happy. But what you're saying now is kind of a step further than that. It's not about the individual's happiness. It's about social equality, I guess, and social fairness. And that touches on a point that I've been interested in for a long time, because you have the UN triangle of sustainability. Mm-hmm. So you have the environmental sustainability and the social and the economic. And that's from back in the 80s when Brundtland did the whole thing. Mm-hmm. Whereas architecture was all about, you know, the environmentally sound solutions and also urban solutions. Mm-hmm. And now it seems to be shifting, or at least including also the social aspects of things. So that's the point I seem to hear that you're making as well, that there's something about the structure of the built environment that needs to be inclusive, because there's a social responsibility going on here as well.
Yes. Well, number one, using the word happiness, there's no more powerful ingredient to human happiness than strong, positive social relationships at all levels. And a big component of that is inclusion. So who has access to the economy, to the riches of place, and to structures, places, and relationships? We see many Americans being deprived of that because of the length of their commute and the challenges of just getting around. Just let me pause for a sec.
Sure.
You led the question talking about Brundtland and social sustainability and what it means, right?
Yes, and what it means to you and your work. Because I felt that I hit a nerve, or you hit the nerve yourself in a way, by going from happiness to talking about social inequality and the unfairness that sometimes the city can be structured in.
Okay. So when we're talking about social sustainability, and particularly inclusion, you know, I hear high-minded language about including the less fortunate or valuing diversity. And to me, that's a little patronizing. From an ethical standpoint, everyone must be included. If you care about a happy society, everyone must be included. And we're just so far away from that place. But also from a practical standpoint, we know from Wilkinson's work in the spirit level that societies that are more equal and where there's more opportunity for everyone experience lower levels of crime and higher levels of productivity and lower health costs, and the list goes on. So it's both a pragmatic and ethical and moral concern. It's only when you come to a place like Florida that you begin to see that those of us who speak about urban design and who are fascinated by it, we need to go further, because design alone is not going to solve these problems. These problems are political and thus philosophical, and we need to decide who really should be included in this project. In the United States, for example, you have a widening gulf between rich and poor, and so there we are in West Palm Beach on their waterfront trying to improve the waterfront experience, and you know, at least a third of our experiment participants commented that, well, it's really the homeless that ruin the waterfront. If they could just get rid of the homeless, well, these so-called homeless people, they're citizens as well, and they have a right to be in public space, and for that space to function, they need to solve this issue in a way that's including of everyone. Can we find a new way of doing that? I have to say, you know, one of inspiration for me came from Copenhagen, following around a couple of planners from your city as they talked about, I believe it was Nørrebro Park. Mm-hmm. Can you pronounce that for me?
Nørrebro Park.
Mm-hmm. And
I used to live just around the corner from that park.
Okay, it's a lovely park, and we took a walk, and these two planners had been in charge of the community process to redesign the park. And they, you know, they got the community out, they invited everyone, and they thought that was great, and then they realized at the end that the drunken bums were not invited. And so they decided to go down to the park with a bunch of beer and talk to these guys. And the drunken bums, you know, first they said, thank you, can I have another beer? And then they explained what they wanted. And what they wanted was remarkable. They wanted a place where they could hang out and not bother everybody else and not be bothered by everyone else. So my recollection is that they built a little compound for them, you know, like a fort with a, you know, a low fence and a gathering space. And when we visited, there they were. Their dogs were inside. They were taking care of the space because they had a sense of ownership. And everyone had their own space in that park. And I wonder if Americans could learn from this deeply inclusive model. What would Americans do? What would our friends in West Palm Beach do? When they complain about the urine smell of the homeless in West Palm Beach, well, how about having a toilet on the waterfront? When they complain about the messiness or the fact that the homeless use public washrooms to wash, how about showers on the waterfront? How about creating places that are so wonderful that everybody feels included and not threatened by the other?
Og her forlader jeg så Charles Montgomery på strandpromenaden i Florida med en historie om min egen hjemby København som et eksempel på inklusivt bydesign. Jeg tænker, at historien om Nørrebroparken vist nok har nogle flere nuancer, så vidt jeg husker. Men jeg er alligevel glad for, at Charles Montgomery taler sig lige ud af posen om sine holdninger og værdier, som ligger bag det arbejde, han gør. Arkitektur og byforskningen finder i disse år nye metoder til at måle og vise, hvordan vi som mennesker påvirkes af det fysiske miljø. Det betyder for mig at se, at vi ikke længere har nogen undskyldning for at bygge og udvikle bygninger og byrum, som fungerer dårligt for mennesker. Du har lyttet til Bylyd, en udsendelse om neurovidenskab og virtual reality. Udsendelsen er tilrettelagt, produceret og klippet af mig, Niels Bjørn. Maiken Vibe Bauer har stået for mix. I redaktionen i øvrigt, Tobias Mo. Musikken i udsendelsen er nummeret Under Suspicion af Lee Rosevere, som er fra albumet Music for Podcasts 2, som musikeren har stillet frit til rådighed for podcastproducenter.